You already know that I am that special kind of irresponsible that keeps making the same mistakes over and over again in perpetuity until I fade into myself like a black hole.
Well, we're all just black holes in potentia, right? We're all waiting to collapse in on ourselves. That's not novel. But people run late. It happens. It happens. But the thing one does when one's running late
is taxed.
I mean, my patience is taxed, motherfucker. What you gotta do is text. Okay, that was over the top. I'm gonna bring that back in.
May 18th, 2017, 2:43 p.m. I, Aaron LaRoche, solemnly swear to never run late again. Or, if I am running late, I will text.
Great, that is legally fucking binding. This is the law now. fuck. Okay. Anyway. Yes. Great. I think I've adequately run a fucking guilt train on you.
My guilt is sated.
Yeah. No. I feel like this covered it. My desire to impose guilt on me, my bloodthirst has been sated now. So I think we're in good shape. I might just start the podcast today with your declaration of texting, because I think it's important that our listening audience know what the fucking deal is.
That's fair. No, I say follow your heart, follow your bliss.
Yeah, apparently my bliss is like petty, exaggerated revenge on like not even genuine impositions, but I'm deep down, I'm an angry, I don't know if you knew this, we've known each other a long time, I think I keep it hidden really well, I'm kind of an angry person.
No.
Yeah, I know, it's a shock. I always seem so easygoing and well-adjusted.
I always thought that you were the kind of cool cat who takes it as it comes. Has a hacky sack on hand and ready to just to kick it old school at any moment.
Yeah, I'm always ready to knock back on a lawn chair and enjoy the day. I just let things go. you know what I was thinking about today? Is you remember when we showed up for improv practice and everybody else was still hungover and asleep, so we just, like, stood outside Ethan's house?
Oh, yeah. That was a fun, i.e., annoying day.
Just thinking of things that I'm never going to let go. Every time anyone has ever been late for anything. I mean, what? Okay, anyway. Cool. So that aside, how you doing? In an on-record sense, we can get to the off-record sense after the fact.
On record, I'm great.
Great, that's great. Everything's great.
It's fucking hot. I am still wearing pants. Good. And a shirt.
Good.
I probably will not be doing that later today.
Well, the never nude lifestyle isn't for everyone, I suppose.
Never nudes, you know, they got something figured out, but what do you do when it gets to be 100 degrees?
Endure.
Sweaty.
Yeah, they got sweat caked jorts. I imagine It's somewhat like someone who has just walked out of the ocean in their jorts, just stiff with salt and never quite dry.
That's how I would describe my humor, never quite dry.
Well, not everybody's the New Yorker.
If I ever become a New Yorker, just kill me.
Oh, yo, actually, comics relevant. The longtime comics editor of the New Yorker retired pretty recently, or, like, is about to retire. I'm not sure on the exact quantum superposition of his current employment, but certainly, like, tendered some sort of resignation, presumably tenderly after years and years and years of doing that. Which, sort of the buzz on the internets.com was that this might be a good thing for women and people of color, which is, you know, interesting. Interesting that that's something that people observed about that.
It's something.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of interesting. I'm being studiously pseudo-neutral here. It's interesting. I'm interested in it. That Francois Mouly is, I guess, art director or some shit. And ends up choosing a lot of comics artists to do covers for The New Yorker, and has a more interesting and a more diverse artistic sensibility than I think the cartoons inside tend to have. So the cover has almost been cartoonier than the cartoons, or like at least more contemporary to what like cartooning now is like. Although she still just hires fucking like Chris Ware for everything. That's not really fair. It's not a Chris Ware problem. And I might mean Daniel Klaus. Okay, here's a confession. Here's some real shit. Do I know the difference between Chris Ware and Daniel Klaus? Yes. Could I tell you at any given moment which of them made a particular thing that I hate? No. They're basically the same.
Yikes. I don't know how I feel about that.
Their art style isn't even that similar, but something about these, like, dead-eyed, morose white men, I'm just like, yeah, you drew a dead-eyed, morose white man, like, hooray. I wish more white men were truly dead inside. That's something I wish from the bottom of my heart. But we're just not likely to get there in this lifetime.
White men have the incredible capacity to bounce back from nothing almost always.
Yeah, they are truly nature's rubber band ball. Why do they exist? Pure excess. They're just commodified excess that someone, you know, they're not serving a function, but they bounce back from anything. And all of their component resources could be better used actually doing something, like serving a function, like holding stuff together. But instead, they're just holding themselves together. So, white men are rubber band balls. It's my highly scientific theory.
Bill Nye would support it.
That's a white man who can stay, actually. I'll let Bill Nye be. Bill Nye is probably wrong about lots of things, but I choose not to engage with that because he was such a relief to me in science classes throughout my whole life, because if Bill Nye was on, we didn't have to actually learn anything, and that helped. I was soothed by it.
Schools don't teach you things. Life does.
I try to live as little life as possible, if we're honest. Like, we're not running a fucking comics podcast because we're really taking life by the throat with our teeth here. We're at like two levels of mediation between us and life. Because we're reading the comics, but then we're also reading them and then engaging with them on a podcast. So we are several steps out from taking lessons from the school of life in this specific endeavor. And then also I like to think that I generally experience life at least a remove of two at all times. That's why I'm on social media, actually. Is the more I can mediate my personal experiences and the less I can actually experience them, the safer I feel.
That's real. That's valid.
Yeah.
Why go through the milieu of actual life when you can, like, cherry pick your experiences?
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to be, like, weirdly filtering my experiences through, like, alienation and, like, postmodern, etc., and also just like being a depresso. So why not also commodify them another level for an audience? You know what that reminds me of in point of fact? And this is, I'll stop tangenting after this maybe, but I saw the worst thing I've ever seen, ever, which was this absolute dude wearing a t-shirt of a Batman Funko Pop.
One more time.
So it was a t-shirt. The picture on the t-shirt was a Batman Funko Pop. You know those toys with the awful oblong heads and the giant staring eyeballs? They look a little bit like Chris Ware drawings, actually.
Okay, I have to look this up. It's not like a bobblehead, right?
They're not. They're, like, super stupid popular in nerd shit. Like, you have definitely, absolutely seen them.
Okay. Yeah. That's a waste of a shirt.
It's how many layers of commodities is that man on? Like, he's not just buying a toy of Batman. He's buying a shirt of a toy of Batman. And it's not even like the Lego Batman where there's like, although I don't love it, there's like a different story being told using the Lego Batman. So its toyness informs a sort of different approach to the Batman story. So if you're wearing a t-shirt of Lego Batman, I still think you're a tool, but you're at least engaging with a piece of media that you have a relationship to, whereas this is just merchandise for merchandise, right? Like, thing of two, at least a remove of two between you and the thing that you supposedly like. It's a t-shirt of a toy of the thing that he, I guess, likes, but maybe not even. Who even likes Batman? I think people just like Batman as a sort of signifier for comicsiness, and it's shit.
He should be canceled.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what his life is. Maybe he's a perfectly nice guy. This is just some rando that I saw walking across a bridge the other day. You are shaking your head like, no, it's not possible that he's a nice guy.
There's some that I have. As someone who wears anime shirts, I can't pretend to be holier than thou. But if you are wearing a shirt with a toy on it that is not discontinued or at least rare, I really don't see the point. It's a waste of your time and your money and everybody else's eyes. Stop it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, do you even enjoy anything at that point? Like, what are you saying? Are you saying just, you know, I enjoy purchases? Is that what that shirt gets to? Because why not just write that? Like, I could respect a shirt that's just like, I enjoy purchasing. Like, cool. I've bought stuff because I'm sad before. Like, what up? But
who hasn't?
Right?
Something that they really don't need. Just because they're a little, just need a little treat.
Yeah. So, like, I'm a hollow person. So I have to buy things to put inside my, you know, the hollow spot where self-actualization would go.
I've been told twice this week to love yourself, and I still don't like it.
doesn't seem like very helpful advice, does it? It's not very actionable. It's like if someone hated broccoli and you were like, well, have you tried loving broccoli? Like, well, no, this experience is bad for me. Whereas my advice for self-love and learning to eat broccoli is just more cheese. Like, just ease the experience down with some cheese. You're like, man, I'm sad and I don't like me. Just eat some fucking cheese whiz out of a can. Similarly, if you're like, I gotta eat some broccoli, this is healthy, cover it in some cheese whiz till you're ready to eat it by itself. A problem solved.
That is life tips.
Yeah.
But that's actual life tips.
Just eat some fucking cheese whiz. Yeah. I think we've done a public service here.
We saved some lives.
Yeah. I mean, we've maybe extended some lives. I think eating cheese whiz straight from the fucking tube will send you to an early grave. Like, we're not really, you know, save them for what is, I think, the question. Like, let's not overcomplicate things. I could say, what kind of life is it, really, just eating cheese whiz straight from the tube? But I already established one where it's easier to love yourself, so fair enough. Good point.
Loving yourself is supposed to be gross. If the person that I told me has taught me anything, it's that it's completely societally acceptable to just be as gross as possible whenever you want. Just shower.
Shower and eat cheese whiz. That's the trade's advice for today.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, read any comics lately?
It was free comic book day last week.
Oh man, we have never discussed the free comics that we respectively picked up on free comic book day before. I am excited to hear for the first time about the comics you got.
Me as well, regarding you.
Great.
Free comic book day is a magical day every year where local comics vendors decide, hey, you spend enough money here, you get a free comic book, let's try and shove these new franchises down your fucking throat.
I was going to question the wisdom of explaining something where the title is literally the premise. It would be a little bit like explaining Shark Attack. Like, there you fucking go. but you are correct to identify the shoving some new franchises down your fucking throat aspect of it. Like, it's not so much free comic book day as it's preview pack. Like, I don't think... I didn't see a lot of standalone content, which I get it, but also at some point you're getting what you paid for, which is some advertising.
Very poorly done advertising at that. Like, my favorite free comic book days are the ones that are from presses that are not DC or Marvel or Dark Horse. It's just like malarkey press, or like, hey, we're new, we're scrappy, we're gonna get in there. I read this one called Love and Capes,
which I have not heard your opinions on before, so please share them in detail for the first time now.
Love and Capes, issue 10, free, is by it's a Malark press, but it is malarkey. It's just your standard superhero romp where there's a super buff crusader and a soon-to-be wife, and, you know, there's, it's very classically drawn. By that I mean, it looks like it's drawn by those people who used to do webtoons on Gizmodo. It's not good. It's essentially, it's the Crusader finding out his soon-to-be wife is also a superhero, and they go out testing out her powers, and he's like, honey, I don't know if you can do that. And she's like, no, I got it. And her clothes come off because she flies too fast. And essentially, she gets a brand new spanking costume and they team up. It's bad. Love and Capes is, it's essentially a, it's a superhero rom-com, which is just a genre that should be discontinued altogether.
Last time that we talked about this, which, let me drop the paper-thin facade that this is not just revisiting an earlier discussion. I don't think you mentioned that her clothes fly off because she fly too fast, bitch.
Yeah. I did not, to be fair, I honestly skimmed this one because it was painful. It was real bad. And it's not like in the comic, like it's not explicit. It's just like, she's like, come on, let's race. And they're flying. And then the Cape Crusader's like, newbies. And then goes to her and is like, I was going to say, air friction can actually become so great that your clothes will burn off. And then her behind the tree is just like, just give me your cape.
Wow, that's, you know, keeping it tasteful. Yeah. Just a little suggestive. What an admirable instance of storytelling. I really feel like that adds value to our understanding of the superhero in this modern age. I really feel like that's just doing something we haven't seen before, which is mildly suggestive nudity and light humor. These two things have never ever been combined before.
I gotta be honest with you, F Stews, I don't like it.
Tell me more.
I think it cheapens the dramatic arc. I think it sort of takes a spotlight off of, you know, this is someone that you're supposed to be marrying, right? They have superpowers that you didn't know about. You should be talking about that. You shouldn't be making cute little jokes flying around.
I regret that I am now engaged in the bad plot of this bad story. Was she concealing these superpowers, or were they unknown to her as well?
Okay. So, this is the worst. Okay. She goes to a doctor.
What?
She goes to a doctor to, I'm just gonna say it.
Yeah.
So, well, in an episode before this, one day his powers got taken away by this weird Dr. Amazo, Captain Fate-like character. So she goes to him to be like, hey, can I get superpowers? And he's like, I don't know if that's a good idea. And then she's sort of like, come on. And he's like, all right. But it's more a love spell, actually. And you can have powers as long as you want, but the way you get them is that you have to kiss your superhero boyfriend. And that's how she got powers, through a kiss.
So there's a doctor who can just administer fucking superpowers? How exactly do superpowers work in this shit-ass world?
I honestly have no idea. A part of me is almost like, maybe I should sincerely go through Love and Capes, but another part of me is like, I don't want to spend money on this.
Yeah, do not. Do not do that. Do not give them that money. My God.
Mark, being a superhero is the biggest part of your life. If I'm going to be your wife, I think I need to know what that's like firsthand.
What? That's dumb as shit.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, let's just extrapolate this for a second. Nobody becomes a fucking accountant because they're marrying an accountant. Nobody's like, honey, figuring out tax deductions for Roth IRAs is the biggest part of your life. And if I'm gonna marry you, I think I need to understand compound interest firsthand.
And I'm not, can I spoil the comic? You're never
Please
gonna read
fucking
it.
Fucking do.
She has the capability to get rid of her powers whenever she wants. She does that standard hero thing where it's like, I saved a lot of people, but not enough people. And she cries over one guy that fell in a bridge that, you know, she saved 14, there were 15, that whole nut chest, nutshell. I don't know what a nut chest is. And she's like, man, being a superhero, it's not for me. And then she falls from the sky. And he catches her, and that's the thing, that's the comic. But they do give her a nice little statue. Love and Capes.
Well, so she's just gonna abdicate responsibility, huh? I mean, I guess. I can't talk too much shit, because I've abdicated every responsibility I've stumbled into, eventually. But that seems like some bit, I mean, that's some Superman's 101, isn't it? And by Superman's, I mean Spider-Man's. Just be responsible for things.
When you pick up the cape, it's not like a day job. It's not like you can just take it off. Also, what a very stressful day to just be like, if anyone's dumb enough to ever, like, consider me a fiancé, like, if my fiancé is like, hey, I'm a brain surgeon, I wouldn't be like, honey, I have to be a brain surgeon to know what it's like so I know where you're coming from for
right?
a day. That would be the opposite of responsible.
Sweetheart, you've run into burning buildings. You've had extensive training to run into burning buildings and save children. So I've decided to put on a fireman suit and follow you. Like,
for love.
You know, the only instance of that kind of being a good idea, kind of, right? So in the fine film Buckaroo Banzai, What?
It is a good movie.
It is, thank you. You know how he's doing neurosurgery? This is your comparison is what made me think of this. With Jeff Goldblum, and he's like, hey Jeff Goldblum, you want to join my band and my superhero, like, secondary job? Because you're pretty good at brain surgery, let's hang out. That worked out really well.
Oh, I agree. Okay. So I can see that being the one... the one good example.
I think the sort of lesson here is if your day job is as fraught and complicated and heroic as taking on part-time superheroing, you can do it. But if it's anything else, you should fucking not. Like, if you're not Jeff Goldblum as a neurosurgeon level, like, heroic and skilled in your day job, fuck on off.
Right.
Right.
Don't be a Subway sandwich employee and be like, all right, I'll be a firefighter for a day just to try it out.
Yeah, you're a sandwich artist. That's okay. Like, workers of the world unite, one big union.
Yeah.
But don't run into situations you're unprepared for no reason.
And to be fair, I doubt firefighters can make as good a sandwich as you.
There is that. Like, one of you has experience in training in one area, one of you has experience in training in another. You should all be making a livable wage, but maybe some of you shouldn't run into burning buildings.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. God, that's... Yeah, Free Comic Book Day is good in theory, but the last few years I've definitely found that I'm, like, less hyped on the free comics than I am on the discounts that many stores do simultaneous to Free Comic Book Day. Of the two, I'm much more interested in getting some comics I actually fucking want at, like, half off or whatevs than I am in picking up more, like, 3-page samples of the new D&Q fall line. No hate, the new D&Q fall line. It's drawn in quality, am I right? But it was nice to see Richard Sala and Jason, like, under the same set of covers, which makes it sound like I'm writing Fantagraphics fanfic, which I'm not. I'm not, like, shipping, as the kids do, America's foremost horror weirdo and Norwegian furry Jason, but... That was a deliberately unfair summation of Jason's career. I respect Jason's work very much. But now that he's doing autobio and he's still drawing himself as a weird people-less dog, like, you know, I think he's at least honorarily a furry. Can we get the furry community to weigh in on Jason? There's enough furries in indie comics. They must have done, right?
I feel like one thing that should be pointed out is Jason is not very furry in his comics. His fur seems very, like, just a coat of white paint.
You're right that he is not into sort of richly textured detail. Everything is a little bit vinyl-y.
Very. Norwegia is very sparse with their emotions and with background.
I don't think you can attribute that to Norway. I don't think you can say that Jason is representing the soul of the Norwegian people. If nothing else, Norway also has a lot of black metal bands, and those are sort of over-textured. Like, corpse paint is not subtle.
Okay, that's fair.
Well, I think about... is Immortal Norwegian? I'm not saying Immortal is good. I'm not saying Immortal represents the soul of the Norwegian people. I fucking hope not. I'm just saying... There's a spectrum between Jason and Immortal.
Is Evanescence from Norway? Because...
They're American. They're from Arkansas.
Okay. It was just I entered in Immortal, and for some reason Evanescence was there as well.
It's a song by them, isn't it?
Yes. Okay. I did not look close enough. So are they both doing segments?
The Fantagraphics and the Drawn In Quarterly collections were basically, like, sample platters for their upcoming graphic novels, which is cool. And the upcoming Sala is the collected Bloody Cardinal, so it's, you know, it's all online already. It's not much of a value-added situation. Which is fine. But it does sort of feel like, well, it's for comic book day, but it's also like it's just previews, so it's not really a comic. I mean, it contains comics, the medium, but it's like it's not like a comic.
I dig it.
Yeah, I mean, that was fine. But I also just bought some comics, and that was a much more rewarding experience overall. Not on free comic book day. After. Later. From the internet.
Well, what have you been reading?
So, I put in an order with Motion, which is a publisher run by one of my, like, high school friends, I guess. So I feel like I should make that disclosure purely because we're technically kind of comics reviewers. So because it's someone I know, I feel like I should say it's someone I know so that we're, like, unimpeachable on our integrity front before I just engage in nepotism or whatever.
People think we have integrity.
I am nothing but integrity. I am integrity through and through.
I am the yin of this situation.
I think we're both reasonably, you know, full of integrity. We're both responsible. Well, well.
It's okay.
Anyway, I bought these comics, and one of them is No Two Self for Crisis Time Plus by Max Huffman, which is a beautiful little book. I'm actually, like, Max is someone who I did improv with in high school. So, like, disclosure, someone I know. Secondary disclosure, younger than me, and I'm a little jealous of how smart he is. Like, because No Two Self for Crisis Time Plus did last year, and it is, first of all, beautifully, beautifully drawn. Like, look at that shit.
That's nice.
Yeah. Max has got a really fluid line. And I think we talk a lot on the trades about our enjoyment of things that are cartoony.
Yes.
One of the things that I think Max does really well is makes the sort of obvious connection between classic modernism in the sort of Picasso vein, the drawings of that kind of cubist modernism, where it's really a deconstruction of the object and the tricks of sight, of deconstructing different vantage points on the object and different ways that objects deform as they move. That was significant, I think, to both cubism and futurism. And one of the things that Picasso did really well, and this is not like an original take on Picasso, but like, rah, 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 who gives a shit? Took those experiments in perspective and made them very appealingly graphic. I think the connection between abstraction in experimental and geometric modern art and like our current phase of like designer minimalism is pretty clear when we think about how graphically appealing a Picasso is, like how reduced those lines are, even as he's adding more and more stuff, like mathematical cubism and shit. And that's something that matters a lot in cartooning and in, like, what we would think of as classic cartoons, the Bugs Bunny and shit.
Hanna-Barbera, the Tex Averys.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're all about the deformation of bodies in motion and the ways that we see things deforming interestingly. And I think Max's drawing makes that connection really clear. Like,
you get blob bodies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And not to be basic, but looking at something like this page, where we're seeing the face from sort of an under angle and a side angle, but we have the extra nostril sort of floating in space. So we're getting both of those perspectives superimposed on each other, but with a very fluid line. So it's got the motion, it's got the absolute painterly stillness there. And then we look at also, and I'm like, I'm not very good with perspective and shit. I should have paid more attention in the one drawing class that other Aaron Berman, made me take, because Aaron was like, you have to do that, though. Thanks, Aaron. But when we look at how the cityscape in the back here, or like townscape, is composed, it's got some of that play with geometric perspective again that feels very like cubist-y influenced, but with a wackiness and an exaggeration that feels very cartoony.
I see it.
And Max,
I see it in the bridge in the back, or whatever that is.
Yeah, the archway there, behind the fountain.
Yes.
That could be a bridge, could be like an Arc de Triomphe type thing. I'm getting some vaguely Euro vibes off this. Yeah, or the way the birds are coming out of this dude's mouth here, which, first of all, the fact that I just said the way the birds are coming out of this dude's mouth here is, like, a lot. But it's true! Resembles the fame... I mean, it doesn't much resemble. But the way that... and some of this is just the obvious connection of, like, it's a bunch of birds. So I know artists hate it when you compare their shit to other shit. I get that. But deal with it.
You have influences. Don't pretend you don't.
But it reminds me a little bit of the famous Escher tessellations of fish becoming birds, where it's sort of dense and warping, and the individual figures become sort of broader and more defined as they go out, which is, of course, just a thing because they're coming out of his mouth. But the, I don't know, the comparison strikes me as possible, if not valuable. And that kind of, and then the body sort of careening backwards there is, as you say, all blob and sort of Avery-esque in its expressiveness.
You gotta have expressions if you're cartooning.
Yeah, it's, I'm very, very soft on these drawings. The three-legged stool with the maybe a lamp popping off in the corner there is another fun madcap position for perspective on this, where you, of course, you have the construction of the walls and the sort of corner there. Like, you didn't have to set that in a corner unless you're deliberately playing with perspective.
And the way with different color, they're different colors of the walls too. Like that guy leaning up against the back being yellow is probably.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like, you have the motion of the birds coming out there, right? And then sort of parallel to them, you've got this yellow guy here. And they're, like, sort of a white line running parallel against a yellow background. Well, he's yellow and coming out against the white, and they both sort of abut each other and, like, overlap in spots. Yeah, and Max is a really, really strong writer. Step inside the problem concourse as is a powerful first sentence for anything. I bought this... partly because I'll just, like, buy things that Max does, because his drawings are real nice. Yeah, see, with the two eyes on the side of the head, that's some, like, the obvious place to go with anytime eyes are doing weird shit is Picasso. So I'm not being smart or original or thinking anything worthwhile, but, you know, it's there. Let's call it out. Is this... the reason I bought this from the previews, aside from... ambient desire to purchase things by people I know, which is sort of an Egotism by Proxy is this two-page spread that was online, which is a shower curtain falling down. So drapery's really hard to draw, is my understanding, for, like, people in general. So the drapery of the shower curtain, the ways that it's suspended by weight on... Suspended by weight is a dumb shit thing to say. The ways that its weight and its suspension on the remaining sort of shower curtain hooks works, the ways that the shower curtain hooks resemble faces. Anyway, just the whole thing. Beautiful little panel. Evokes despair somehow to me. Maybe that's just because, like, shower curtains falling down, you never bothered to put them back up. It's just a depression thing that I did in my previous apartment. But it's fine. It's fine. It's a normal person to be. And the text next to it is, you're part of a community now, exclamation point. So that sort of disjunction of this scene with nobody in it, with an object that resembles a person a little bit, but nobody in it, or at least nobody visible. And in fact, the place where someone might be is obscured, and it sort of stinks of neglect a little bit with the shower curtain falling down, no one putting it back up. Even if someone is in there taking a shower, the furthest bit of water is like past where a person would be. It's just not a lot of space for a person there.
They're very huddled. They're in there.
Yeah. So, yeah, I love it a lot. And I think I talked about the last thing I picked up from Max, which was also about my sort of pet interest in, like, the fuck is the self, though? So, a very, very good comic. And I like a lot of Max's stuff. The other thing that I want to briefly touch on is Max has developed really, really strong lettering, and is really interested in, like, visual text in a way that is really consistent with what I've decided to consider an interest in a geometric perspective. If we look at the lettering in No to Self for Crisis Time Plus on the inside cover, Crisis Time looks like it's made out of sheets of paper or ribbon, so you have to, you know, there's the concern of making it legible, there's the concern of getting all of those flat planes right so that they read, like, plausible sheets. It's just a really, like, elaborate and beautiful thing.
I did not get the time. The time is hard for me to forget.
I think some of that's just because you're looking at it over a grainy Skype connection, but yeah, the M is a little... because the letters are not only, you know, independent planes, they're planes that are overlapping each other, especially in time there, it's a little harder to read. And if you thought that was hard to read, there's the section in the middle, that's just difficult to read lettering. It's very beautiful, and I still have not entirely deciphered all of it.
Wow.
Yeah. And they're sort of almost nonsense phrases. They're like... compelling in the way that most surrealism is, exceed the deed zone, catch me in the symbol crevice. I think one might say mind your mind egg. I think one says back on the word canoe, that kind of thing. So they're not sensible phrases. But of course that's appealing to the odd logic of the rest of the book. So, I talked about that at great length, but I really, really like it. And it's one of the comics that I'm like, I enjoy a lot, and it makes me feel like I'm very stupid. Cause it's such a beautifully constructed object. There's so much going on texture wise, and the ways that the texture sort of evokes, computer fill, might be computer fill. The ways that repetitive textures necessarily, to me, evoke early computer design. You know, shit we all did with, like, the paint bucket. The ways that overlapping and clashing textures evoke magic eye stuff, like, evoke looking for more that's there, the ways that layers work there. the ways that this kind of surrealism and, I want to say, generally repetitive computer-y looking patterns, because some of it's a bit pixely, in contrast with Max's very organic line, evokes a kind of retrofuturism. And that's there in a panel with, like, some science-y shit going on, where it's beakers and test tubes and men in suits and ties. So what do we do with retrofuturism? What do we do with... And if we're drawing back on the ideas of, like, my possibly self-indulgent and reductionist, because I'm a dummy, but it's fine, comparisons to Picasso et al., you know, that too was a futurism. And then, of course, there's just fucking regular-ass Italian futurism, which were fascist, but it's fine. And they were, of course, very cartoony. They were very interested in following distortions of motion. My favorite sculpture, Unique Forms of Continuity in Space, is that like, bronzy walking dude with spiky ankles. Anyway, I always think of that as basically being a cartoon, because it's tracing his motion as he walks. So all of those things together, it's just such a beautiful thing to look at. It's such a beautiful thing to spend time on. And I don't know. Recently I'm on a kick where I only like comics that make me feel inferior. So I thoroughly recommend everyone buy it. I thoroughly recommend everyone think about it. Give Max your money. Partly because if people I knew in high school succeed, then I can just feel worse about myself forever. I mean, no, it's good. I want my friends to succeed. My friends for my whole life, not just my friends now. And also, I need an excuse to feel bad about myself, so buy Max's comic.
Some people would call that support.
I don't like to think I'm a good person, because then I have to sustain that, and that's exhausting.
Fair. Totally fair.
Yeah. And the other comic that I got from Motion that I really, really liked is Andrew Alexander's The Grievin' of Mount Privado, Part 1.
Oh.
Yeah.
That looks gross.
You would love it. It opens with a fucking dead dog.
Yeah. What is it hung?
That's the mystery!
I'm into it.
Yeah. I'm, like, struggling on what the art reminds me of. And I know, like, art doesn't have to remind you of anything. But it does, and I don't know what... And it... You know what I think it is? It reminds me a little bit of Forceman. Your fave. Not a
the
lot.
Ring. Yeah.
Not a lot, yeah. But some... Just a scooch.
I see it.
Oh, shit. No, you know what it also reminds me of? Oh, God. It was Distroed by Forceman, which is why I'm remembering it now. It's from Oily, which I think is Forceman's deal. Does their website even exist anymore? Fucking tits. Okay. That's the most useless thing I've ever said. As a person, as an anything. I contribute nothing to this podcast.
You contributed the pizzazz, the EL.
I contribute the swears. That's really what I do. Fuck. It doesn't matter. I'm not going to find it. But the aesthetic does remind me a little bit of some stuff that came out from Oily. So, kind of. Now that I've like identified that, I'm like thinking about like 80 different Oily comics that it reminds me of a little bit, but that might just be the printing process if I'm honest with myself, in that it is inky and a little sparse. But yeah, I mean, it's another comic that's very interested in people. My initial take on it was to think of it in relationship to Brick, the neo-noir or whatever, because it's high school kids and crimes.
Great movie.
My improv coach in high school loved it. So that's really where we're at today, is like improv nostalgia. Fuck.
Yes, and brick is good.
Fuck. Okay. That was just a quack. My swears have devolved into quacks at this point. But the other obvious comparison, anytime dark shit is happening at a high school and somebody's, like, the kids are trying to solve it, is David Lynch. And in the Lynchian vein, it's much more interested in teasing out personal histories and personal connections than it is in actually telling you what happened. Like, it's much more interested in using a mystery as an inciting incident to go into what was already there.
Okay.
So that's the lens it uses to show you these relationships that already existed. And to sort of exacerbate tensions between them, so you're seeing the most version of that existing dynamic.
Is it like jumps in time, or is it just like thought bubbles? In the comic, what I was trying to ask is, it like, does it go to different points, like actually showing what happened, or is it people like just talking about what happened?
So the whole thing takes place over the course of one day between 5:23 a.m. and mystery ass o'clock, but generally like probably midnight-ish the next morning, because this dude passes out at 10 p.m. And at the bottom of every page is a little digital clock. So it keeps you in that one timeline, but it does have visually rendered flashbacks of what people are describing happening or having okay. happened.
Like 24.
I have never watched 24, but I believe you. So the thing about it that I like wanted to use it as an excuse to talk about that has almost nothing to do with it, although I like it a great deal and I recommend people spend their money on it, because it's just a very nice, it's like a nice big comic, and it's nice to look at. Like, people have weird faces. Some of the character design is a little bit Dashaian, maybe, in the ways that like people's hair looks, the kinds of defining features people get, but overall, because it's much inkier and grimier line work, to borrow from a different review of this same comic that I would attribute, but I don't remember who wrote it, so whatever. Whoops. No, I can find that out.
Everything's online now.
Yeah, you can do that. It's possible.
It sort of reminded me of Charles Burns a little bit.
I don't think that's a bad comparison. Okay, so from High Low Comics, there's a review that talks about this as ratty line, a la Gary Panter. So if you like that kind of thing, and if you like immaculately rendered, bland, cheap houses, that's really what struck me in this, if I'm honest. Is there's a couple scenes of the interior of somebody's shitty apartment. Not especially shitty, but, like, not very nice. That I was like, yeah, wow, that's really true. Something about the way this dude draws small town, and especially, like, not just interiors, but, like, intimate views of these houses. There's a keen eye for a certain kind of furnishing and a certain kind of layout, especially of what generic housing, I don't know, generic's not the right word, because that implies that it's not about it in its specificity, but like corporate housing.
Okay.
Places
so, like denoting class, kind of, or denoting like where you,
yeah
high school housing.
Yeah, like I think class is dead on. Like, look at this scene of him opening his little chain link fence out past his house. Like,
okay.
It's very specific, and it feels basically like correct on some level about what that kind of place looks like.
He would live there. Like, you look at the house and you look at the person, and it's like some dogs look like their owners, some houses look like their renters.
Kind of, yeah. I think even if and this is a thought exercise that I like because I'm not a nice person. If you took the people out entirely, the house would still look like that. Like, it feels like a house that you could walk into and it would be real. Like, it's not dependent on the character design, but you're correct that it fits the character design. It feels to me like it points outside of the characters, and that lends the text something that it otherwise wouldn't have.
I feel that.
And, like, I don't want to dismiss what you said, because it's absolutely correct that it does match, and it feels plausible that those people would live there. But to me, that also suggests that they've created the right people for the house, more than that they've created the right house for the people.
I get what you're saying.
Yeah. Not to be... I don't know, I think that's still pretty humanist. I am enemies with all object-oriented ontologists, because I think that we view things entirely through society, and, like, fuck you. But, you know, it feels like a real environment. And that's probably a point of contrast with, like, Lynchianism, where, you know, they're, like, a real environment, but not because it's all layered through, like, Lynchian dreamovision, which is necessarily a very strong aesthetic standpoint. And while there is a strong aesthetic standpoint, and arguably in some ways it's even stronger because this is drawn, and drawn with a very specific kind of line, as opposed to the filmic eye of the camera, which generally lies a little bit about things happening. It gives an impression of things having happenedness out of habit as much as anything else, but, like, it's a little something. Smarter people than me have devoted years of their lives to thinking it through, and I'm just going to be like, meh, the cameras are liars.
I mean, especially if it's a mystery.
Yeah, so the reason I'm, like, dicking around with Lynchianism is I was talking to some people, some presumably smart people, who will remain nameless in this instance. Because I'm about to talk some shit. Who were talking about how Riverdale subverts and, like, is novel for subverting the image of 1950s goodness.
Are you talking about the Archie show?
Yeah, buddy.
Are you watching that show?
Shit, no.
Okay. I was about to, like, do an intervention.
No. I don't watch any show with a murder rate of fewer than one per episode. Like, minimum. It's like, okay, if every episode doesn't either have priests or murders, that's kind of my two things. Like, either it's got to have all priests all the time, or minimum one murder per ep. Like, I'm a simple soul. It's the clergy, or it's murder. That said, Riverdale is a little bit culturally inevitable right now. And I think you get that. I think you're, like, you've seen enough. I'm saying I can judge the show without ever having watched it, is what I'm saying right now. It's not, like, true, but it's what I'm gonna do. So let's just accept as a given premise that I do what I want and no one can stop me. Okay?
You got it. Do your thing.
Good. So the whole notion of, like, it's a wholesome thing, but it's got a dark underbelly, is itself a trope. It's a trope. It's the only thing you could do with Archie at this point.
Ugh.
You're shaking your head. Talk to me about what that means. I get the sense that you hate the show.
It's just trying... It's following the... they're trying to be Twin Peaks. They're trying to be, like, a mystery show with no actual mystery. It's like a teen... It's a teen romp with no point. It's just insulting to me. It's insulting to, like, hey, we're going to make a live-action Archie series, and it's all about, I don't know what's happening in the show, but I'm assuming that someone has a secret or someone gets murdered, and they're like, oh, which one of us did it? And along the way, they find out troubling truths about them. themselves.
Yeah, Betty's older sister's secret boyfriend got murdered, and she's pregnant. And they gotta get to the bottom of it, and Jughead's deadbeat dad is, like, at the center of the mystery.
It's just...
I watched one episode while I was in Florida. Not my fault, really. Yeah, I mean, I think that it's trying to be Twin Peaks is correct, and something that I'm, like, interested in is, like, why so many pieces of media try to subvert small town when I think small town at this point contains its own subversion. Like, I don't think from, your fucking fave, Dame Angela Lansbury as, what's her name, the crime solver from Maine. Murder, She Wrote.
Yep.
That's the one. I apologize for insulting your show that way. I recognize that was unfair to the series. I was having a moment of brain.
I mean, they're fine. It's a world-renowned and well-respected series.
You're right. My opinion can't hurt it. It's past me. Point being, from her to... the source material that she's arguably ripping off a little bit with,
the Christies and the...
Yeah, Agatha Christie up through Lynch. The myth of the small town, the myth of the quiet, peaceful small town has never been untroubled. So to me, it's more useful to think of the ways that, like, these individual subversions actually function than just to identify that they subvert this trope that doesn't really... happen in its unsubverted form very often. Because there are ways to do it that are cynical, and there are ways to do it that maintain their innocence throughout. Like, Murder, She Wrote always suggests that it's a surprise. It's a surprise every time that there's a murder. It's not always a surprise to the audience, and we get some winks to that in various texts. But to the characters, it's always a surprise that, like, the place is not what it seems.
This place should be safe. I raise my peaches here. No one can get murdered in a place where I plant peaches.
Yeah. And, like, my fave Agatha Christie series is the... Well, I haven't watched enough of them to make that claim definitively. The one that I enjoyed a lot was the Miss Marple from, like, the early mid-aughts that, like, was very wink and a nod. At least in the early ones, it fell off the tracks as it went along. But nevertheless, for the characters, the loss of their peace and their innocence of their town. And this was part of where the wink and a nod came in, was it followed through on the loss of innocence and the loss of peace much more than is usually done in that kind of cozy mystery, where it, like, wraps up on a point where you can feel that some kind of order and justice has been restored to the town, even though it's shaken. Whereas this particular Marple series will, like, show you the fucking execution. And you're like, oh, that's... You, like, took that to a new place, huh? Like, that's hard. To say that Riverdale subverts the wholesome image of Archie Andrews is to suggest that, like, even when the comics play Archie Andrews straight, which is not, pun intended, which is not necessarily often anymore, because there's all that Archie versus Punisher, Archie goes to hell... Like, the series itself has been very inventive in, like, spinning off updated versions that, like, play with that wholesomeness very deliberately. But even when the series plays it straight, audiences don't necessarily. Like, Jughead and Archie fucking has been a thing forever. So, the source material has not been played straight, with rare exceptions, for forevs.
Yeah, he was a zombie for longer than he's been on TV.
Yeah, so, like, I don't have any strong, like, I don't object to small town turned upside down. I mean, I fucking love The Grieving of Mount Pravada. Like, good fucking shit. But I think that's because it's more effective at what I'm interested in, which is digging into the sort of grit of the small town in its small townness, rather than just like subverting it in a way that throws that out, that says that the thing that's true is the gore and the intrigue. It really, hi Maze, it sinks its teeth a little bit more into the ways that the grimy already coexists with the small town. And I mean, this is especially true because the characters in The Grieving of Mount Pravada are already dropouts or like folks who graduated high school but are just like living at home, not going to college. Like, one's a drug dealer. But like small town. Not like glamorous. Small town griminess is, I think, seen for what it is. And that's appealing. And okay, that's always hack. It's always hack to say that something is seen for what it is, because what is anything anyway? Bleh. But I think I'll let it ride in this instance, if only in the interest of time. So I think being interested in the small town through the lens of something horrifying is more interesting to me than claiming to subvert the small town. And that's why I think Cooper is so appealing. What up, Twin Peaks Revival? I'm probably not going to watch it. Whoops! Because I don't watch things. It would cut into my staring at nothing, sadly, time, which is really, you know, some people meditate. Some people stare sadly at nothing. I'm the latter camp. It's very, like, holistic, in that I'm wholly empty.
The meditation for meditation for Sartre readers.
Yeah, you know, just people who are in the middle of the existential crisis. Like, I'm not moving towards transcendence anytime soon, thanks.
Yeah.
En soi, pour soi is enough soi for me. Anyway, yeah, that's why I think Cooper's sort of appealing, is... Cooper is sort of romanced by the small town.
I mean, he loves the coffee and the donuts.
Yeah.
That's the big thing. A city slicker comes in, or someone who is, like, used to... Someone who is disaffected by the world around them comes into some place quaint, and it's just like, oh, wow, things... There are nice things left. And then they realize that there are no nice things left.
Well, I mean, and Cooper's not disaffected at all. Cooper is very open to the magic of the world. Cooper wants to see the small town as they want to be seen, and it's his job to see them as they are. And the collaboration between those two things, someone who's very much invested in seeing goodness and beauty and believing in goodness and beauty when he's given the opportunity to... you know, he gets shit-ass excited over the Bookhouse Boys, which arguably, right, are a bunch of podunk men exercising their masculinity by drinking beers. But they believe in themselves as knights, basically. Protectors of the town. And Cooper believes in that because he wants that to be true. That's not entirely true. Cooper's magic is that he will believe in that goodness, and he will draw that goodness out. I think the Bookhouse Boys becomes real with the addition of Cooper. So, you know, Cooper is a co-conspirator in the magic of the small town and in the goodness of the small town, even while his coming to it is only possible because of the griminess that was already contained in it. And that's where shit like, okay, I'm not going to do a full rehash of it. I'm not. I promise I'm not going to subject you to my, like, here's my takes on Twin Peaks, because ain't nobody need that. Yeah. So, that kind of interest in valuing and seeing people and small towns as relationships between people fundamentally, because that's what people claim to like about small towns, right? You can know your neighbors. Well, what's that fucking mean? Although, of course, that's also, like, true in cities, and necessarily part of the myth of the small town is where you know your neighbors is a racist myth. Because urban centers, as places where communities of color are communal, right, and are communities, is necessarily also a true story. And one that's, like, hidden by the mythology of the urban jungle, which is, of course, a racist phrase. So...
True that.
Yeah. So white people's fantasy of the city is, like, a harsh, like, a necessarily harsh place because people have made a choice to be disconnected from each other because the city, the architecture of the city disconnects them from each other, is fundamentally a racist mythology. And I'm reading J.G. Ballard's High Rise, which I hate like a motherfucker. And he blames approximately the cruelty of these rich people on their high-rise environment. But the high-rise is based on a fucking affordable housing structure that was not occupied by fucking rich people to start with. So go to fucking hell, J.G. Ballard. So yeah, small town, know your neighbors. What's up with knowing who's on the block, though? Like... So, okay, let me reel that back in, because nobody needs this much. So, small town, a site for community, is interesting to Lynch and is sacred to Cooper. And we can talk about the incredible whiteness of that, but, like, what would a Twin Peaks set in the Bronx look like as a different kind of question about knowing each other? But they would never get a federal... agent sent in to investigate somebody turning, like a kid turning up dead.
In the Bronx? No.
Because the government doesn't care. So that's the other half of Twin Peaks is like, what's up with that story? Well, it is white people dying, so the government gives shit. So, okay, sorry. I feel like I took that to a stupid place, but, or at least a non-productive one.
It's the myths we build around communities.
Yeah.
That's the structure, the responses we get, you know? Like, what's that Ballard dude saying with his high rise is essentially saying, why don't all these people, you know, cooperate with me? Why don't they like me? Because they don't know you, and you don't take any... The mysteries, so many mysteries could be solved if people took an effort to get to know the people they suspect. it wouldn't be easy, but it'd at least be more productive.
Yeah. I should say High Rise is not a mystery. It's just Lord of the Flies, but set in a building rather than an island. The idea is that all these rich people move into a brutalist high-rise modeled after Balfron Tower, which is currently, I'm just gonna high horse for a sec and then I'll get back off the high horse, is currently being fucking art washed and like socially cleansed is the language that's come out of the tenants being kicked out. Because some rich people decided that they actually wanted to live in this brutalist tower that J.G. Ballard pretended rich people lived in because he hated it. So he said a story of, like, doctors and lawyers just murdering the shit out of each other and descending into chaos in this building because he was like, well, I fucking hate it. I'd hate living there. I'm miserable. Brr, 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 brr. I'm a jackass. I wrote Crash. So he did that. But Balfron Tower, built by Goldfinger, who, fucking, what's his name, hated the building so much that he named the James Bond villain after the architect. So, it's at the site of a lot of bad culture. Anyway, they're getting fucking kicked out, because now rich people want to live there, because now it's cool to live in concrete buildings. So my hope is that they're actually going to go full fucking high rise and just murder the shit out of each other. And then people who need affordable housing can move the fuck back in. That's my hope.
Yay, class murder.
Yeah, if rich people would actually just murder each other like J.G. Ballard fantasizes they would, it would be better for me. And the world. The world is more important than me. I'm just angry in general.
I agree to disagree.
Like, with the idea that rich people should murder each other? Because, fair enough. Anyway.
No, the world is more important.
That's a utilitarian framework. I realize not everybody's a utilitarian, and I'm probably not even a serious utilitarian, but... wow, that wasn't useful. But yeah, you're right to draw out that thread of, like, myths communities draw around each other, and a not insignificant part of the Grievan of Mount Pravado is, like, one of the characters who grows weed identifies the role that other people play in the community and compares it to the role of chess pieces. And you're right to identify that if people got to know each other, they wouldn't necessarily see each other as filling roles, although I'm not sure that's the claim that Mount Pravado is making. So, yeah. I can, like, hear the apartment examining people outside the door, so we might cut us off there unless you have another text you want to talk about.
I'll save it for next time. This one's a little bit of a doozy.
Okay. As always, thank you so much for listening. You can find us at thetrades.podomatic.com or on Facebook at The Trades Podcast and on iTunes now as well. So if you like the show, please consider rating us. Or if you like us as people and you want to be best friends, please also consider rating us. Okay, great. Thanks so much.